Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Alaska Edition on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer. Today we'll be talking about some of the week's events that are likely to shape things to come in Alaska. Joining us today are KUCB News Director Lauren Rosenthal from Skype from Unalaska. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Ellen. How are you?
Good. And from the Matanuska Susitna Borough, Assemblyman Jim Sykes. Hi, Jim.
Pleased to be here.
And Nancy Merriman has joined us. She's with the Alaska Primary Care Association. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show. I'd like to start with some Bering Sea groundfish issues. Lauren, I'd like to address this to you. Apparently, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council undertook some very important action regarding the Chinook bycatch in the Alaska's pollock fishery this week, or on Sunday, I believe. But can you give us sort of a background on what is the issue with bycatch? We hear that word a lot, and it comes up with the Chinook salmon subsistence fisheries all the time. Could you give us the thumbnail on that?
Sure. I mean, the main problem is that you have a lot of fish out in the Bering Sea. You have Chinook salmon that go there to feed, and the Bering Sea is also the setting for what is the nation's largest commercial fish harvest for pollock. When Chinook salmon started to do really badly almost a decade ago now, a lot of people blamed the pollock industry and the trawl boats for decimating those salmon stocks by pulling up too much salmon. And they really were taking in a lot back in those days. Their numbers peaked around 120,000 Chinook in 2007. So the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which we're talking about now, they decided to take action by setting up a system of limits on how many Chinook the fleet can actually take. So for boats that agree to use special nets to let salmon swim out, that agree to participate in closures when there are too many salmon on the grounds, they're going to be held to about 60,000 fish every year. And if they go over that, their harvest will be shut down. And if vessels don't want to take all of those extra steps, they're going to be held to a slightly lower standard, a lower limit on how many salmon they can catch. Now, a lot of pollock captains have said they just ignore all of the numbers and they try to fish as cleanly as they can. And if you look at the numbers, you can see over the last couple of years, it's been working. Now their bycatch number is around 15,000 Chinook most years. But not everyone's on board. Fishing clean costs money. It's extra fuel. It's extra time. And there have definitely been some seafood companies that just don't want to take those extra steps. And at the same time, you have subsistence fishermen in Western Alaska. You have commercial salmon fishermen who have taken huge losses over the last couple of years. I mean, their fisheries are being shut down. So until this past weekend, when the North Pacific Council took action, the pollock industry wasn't being asked to take any extra sacrifices.
Okay, so what did the council's action do exactly? Will it stop the bycatch entirely or what?
It's probably not going to stop it entirely. Basically, what they decided to do is set a sliding limit on how many Chinook salmon the fleet's going to be allowed to catch. So they're going to look at three rivers in Western Alaska. That's going to be the Upper Yukon, the Kuskokwim, and the Unalakleet rivers. And the year after those rivers have...
Well, it looks like we've lost...
...had a really bad run. The bycatch limits are going to drop by 25% for all.
Okay.
Sorry?
Okay, it looks like we're losing our Skype connection, but stand by. And it looks like this council action will actually help the bycatch issue, but it will not go into effect immediately. So let's turn to the Mat-Su Valley. Jim Sykes, last night, actually, you sent a letter to Mat-Su's legislative delegation in Juneau asking them to join Governor Walker in his veto of HB 132. So tell us, first of all, what is HB 132 and why should we be concerned, or why are you concerned?
Well, I think a lot of people are concerned because HB 132 is essentially a non-compete clause forcing the state of Alaska to only do the AK LNG project with the producers that are part of the project and not do anything else. It basically forces the state to ask permission from the other partners in the AK LNG to have access to our own resources. And it's not a good place to be because our state has a constitutional provision that we are supposed to control this for the enhancement of Alaskans. So it has problems on many levels. For Matsu, just yesterday we had two very important visitors to the port, and they were from Japan. We had the general manager of JOGMEC, which is a gigantic consortium of Japanese companies that do oil, gas, and mineral business around the world, about $18 billion worth. And we had the vice president of REI, which is Resources Energy, which has been working to get a project where they will get our gas. And so when you have a HB 132 as a non-compete clause, basically, it could cast a cloud or shut our window of opportunity that we are doing these other projects. And one of the big problems that we have is that if any of the partners in the AK LNG line leaves it, then the state has no other options if HB 132 is going to pass. We basically have to go back to the drawing board while the companies are free to pursue their other projects if they choose to do them. It makes sense to me that we should also be able to have options in case the AK LNG project doesn't go forward, whether it's the ASAP line or the REI project, or we didn't mention Westpac. And for Matsu, we would like to see the terminus for the AK LNG or the ASAP line, in addition to these other projects, be considered. So the economic development of our port of Mackenzie and South Central Alaska, and really the state, could be hurt if we put our eggs in one basket and this is the only option we've got. So we think that the governor's going to veto this, and the gravity of the situation is very real. These kind of things come up where we, as Alaskans, come together. People on the street say, why are we doing this? And on the assembly, the person that I generally don't agree a lot with, we're 100% behind this.
Okay, so I know that the Matsu Borough has spent years now building up the port and trying to get the railroad spur going and attracting LNG businesses to locate at the port. So why would the Matsu legislative delegation vote for something that is going to hurt the economic growth of the Matsu?
Well, I wish they were here to answer that question. I don't know why they did it, but I think if you take a look at the way the legislature works, when we got the new governor, when Governor Walker came, he said, I need this other option. And this other thing was already in motion, and people were behind it. And so I think that there was a leadership kind of enforcement of what was going on. And that was actually highlighted when Representative Reinbold was thrown out of the coalition. She voted against a budget measure. And I think that said, well, if you guys are going to do this, it helped enforce the discipline of the leadership. And now I think that people are beginning to reflect that this might have been just a little bit hasty of an action, because the only choices we now have are this is either going to become law or the governor's going to veto it, and it'll either be overridden or it won't.
Well, the governor's told Mike Chenault he will veto it, and apparently Saturday, tomorrow, is the deadline. What are the chances of a turnaround between now and tomorrow night?
Well, I just think that legislators are going to really think about this, not only in terms of Alaska, but in terms of Matsu, and say, what are we really supposed to be doing here? And I hope that the cooler heads will prevail, because I think that, the HB 132 is kind of a poke at the governor in the heat of the moment. And now we can actually see that there's some real negative downsides for the state if this goes through. So that's my hope, is that this will get reconsidered, and people can perhaps vote on the budget, and then they will be free from the constraints of the leadership that they agreed to as a coalition, and then they can really vote on the merits of the bill. And I believe that if they get that chance, they will say, this is better for the state, this is better for Matsu, and hopefully they'll come down on the right side of it.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Are we getting Lauren back? Can you hear me? No? Okay.
I can hear you.
Okay, let's finish up with Lauren and her Chinook issue. I was going to ask you before we broke the connection, will the North Council's action take effect anytime soon? I know it takes quite a while to get the approval.
Yeah, that's tough to say. The council functions as basically a group of advisors for the U.S. Department of Commerce, and turning all of this into a law is going to be up to them. So there's no chance this would go into effect before next year. On top of that, the council has asked that before this becomes a law, they get a chance to take another look to make sure that what they're intending to do it actually ends up happening in the scope of this new law.
Okay, and one more for you. If it does go into effect, how are they going to be able to judge the effect on the Chinook salmon runs in the Alaska's rivers?
That is going to be incredibly difficult. Scientists have been trying to figure out how to gauge the impact of the bycatch that's already happening. And when you compare how many salmon this pollock fleet's taking out to the size of the runs in the rivers, something like a 2% impact rate. We know that about half of the Chinook salmon that the pollock fleet is taking as bycatch, is taking on accident, comes from Western Alaska rivers. So if there's less bycatch, there should be more salmon going back to those rivers. However, we know so little about what's happening to Chinook to make them kind of die off like this, that it's really impossible to say how many we could expect to see going back up to spawn and be caught by subsistence fishermen and commercial users along the rivers.
Okay, thanks, Lauren. I'd like to turn our attention now to another resource. We've talked about gas, we've talked about fish, but human resources are important too. And Nancy Merriman, I would like to talk to you a little bit about what's going on with Medicaid in our state. There's a rally going on right now in Wasilla. There was one in Anchorage last night, one in Juneau yesterday. What is it about this Medicaid expansion issue that has so captured the public's passion?
Well, I think it captures people's passions and emotions because I think we all know someone who doesn't have health coverage. In fact, for me, and this I think has happened to a lot of my friends as well, that as we move from one job to the next even, your health coverage comes into question as you make those transitions. And we certainly all know somebody who doesn't have any health coverage at all. So it hits us at our hearts, for sure. But it also hits Alaskans in their pocketbooks. We all know that the Medicaid program is a really big budget item for the state of Alaska. So it hits all of Alaskans in that way. It also, you know, I think it hits our minds too, because we all know that we want all Alaskans to be healthy, that it makes a difference to our communities, it makes a difference to our economy, it makes a difference to us personally. So I think that's why.
Okay, so who would benefit from Medicaid expansion if it went in right now, and who would pay for it?
Well, you know, we all would benefit. Everybody would benefit because if all Alaskans are healthy, then we all contribute to the community. We all are contributing to the economy. The other thing is that as people gain coverage, they are able to maintain their health. And to get care early when they're not healthy, they're also able to carry through with their treatment when they have health issues and have a treatment plan. So it affects everybody. One thing that does happen is when people don't have health care coverage, they end up in care at a much later time in the progression of their diseases or their conditions. So they end up in primary care or hospitals even, in emergency departments where they cannot pay for that care. And so there's this thing called uncompensated care that happens to the tune of about $94 million a year in our Alaskan hospitals and about $22 million a year for community health centers across the state. And the cost of that gets spread across all of our individual health insurance plans, business health insurance plans. Insurers need to be able to spread out that loss that they incur. So the question I think is not who would pay for it, but who would pay less. And I think that answer is all Alaskans.
Right. Well, now opponents to Medicaid expansion often say, well, reforms need to take place because the Medicaid program is broken. How would you answer those skeptics?
Oh, I think that health providers and I think in hospitals and primary care, you know, we work closely with all of the safety net providers, so tribal health system, behavioral health, primary care, hospitals. And we all agree that the Medicaid system can be improved. And there are four bills right now in front of the legislature, which can be divided into basically two sets, one of which addresses both reform and expansion, and another set addresses just reform alone. Really substantially, the reforms in all of those bills are very similar. They all aim to get better health care outcomes for the patients who are cared for in the Medicaid program, to decrease costs to the program, and to benefit the entire system and the population. So reforms are necessary. The reforms that primary care would like to see include primary care provider-driven care management and case management, payment reforms that actually emphasize value over volume, reforms that recognize patient-centered medical home practices that really emphasize coordinated and integrated care and care coordination for those patients. Reforms are, though, long-term. That's not a point in time. And we think that's really the long haul.
Okay, so given that the clock is running out on this legislature, what if Medicaid expansion does not pass this session? What then? What's the likelihood?
Well, what we would hope is that the governor would recall legislators to a special session where they would be given the time to consider all of the issues that face Medicaid expansion, all of the issues that are involved. There's a lot of evidence out there, good evidence, that Medicaid expansion is a good thing to do for the state economically, that it increases revenues across the economy, that it creates jobs, that people's health is improved. So there's a lot of evidence out there. We think that if given enough time, the legislators can consider all of that evidence, that they would come to the right conclusion, and that their skepticism about expansion would evaporate.
Okay, thanks for that update, Nancy. Let's get back to the Matt Sue and a little more fish over here. Jim, Governor Walker has put forward a fellow, Robert Ruffner, as an appointee for the Board of Fisheries, yet I believe earlier this week or last weekend, two of the Matsu legislators sort of testified against Ruffner's appointment at a public hearing. What do you know about that?
Well, I don't know what the reason that they testified against the appointment. I did visit just last night the Fish and Game Advisory Board to the Matsu Borough Assembly, and they were discussing it. I didn't stay long enough to know if they came to a conclusion, but they were really going through the man's qualifications, and I can say that they thought his background was good, and the thing that they really liked is he seemed to be based on science, which is really what our Fish and Wildlife Commission is all about. These are people that worked in agencies for years to try and come up with the best recommendations to restore our fish runs in the rivers in the valley. And like I said, they didn't come up with a decision, but I would say the tone of the conversation was positive. They were thinking that he could be a fair board member, and I don't know where they came out on it, but the discussion was pretty positive.
Okay, certainly he's a Ruffner by his own statement. I'm reading opinion pieces in the Alaska Dispatch. He's a big dipnet fan. He says he stocks his freezer. His whole family eats dipnet caught salmon, so he's totally a personal use kind of guy. But I was going to say that right now there's 89 appointees to boards and commissions sort of hanging in the balance. The governor had called for a joint session this morning. The Senate decided to push that till Sunday, the last day of the legislature. So he's not alone in waiting to get the final word on whether, Ruffner isn't alone on waiting to get the final word on whether he's been appointed or not. And let's get back to you, Lauren. Can you hear us now? Okay. A couple more questions for you. Like, only yesterday, the Federal Subsistence Board decided not to vote on a proposal to turn over salmon management on federal lands on the Kuskokwim and Yukon River to the federal government, opting instead for maybe more cooperation with the state. And this is a byblow of the lack of Chinook salmon in our rivers. So I was just going to wonder if you could draw the line between the council's action and more salmon in the rivers. And you've explained that very well, but I wanted to get back to the fact that maybe the outcome won't be apparent for maybe a few years.
No, it's definitely not. But something interesting that came up during this kind of federal advisory council meeting we had in Anchorage this past week, so captains were saying they've been seeing a lot more salmon on the grounds already. And, you know, they're concerned that if their bycatch limits drop, they're going to be put in a position where they can't help but catch more fish, and then that creates all kinds of headaches for them. Well, that could potentially be good news for subsistence users and commercial users who are waiting to see runs kind of bounce back to a more normal state. You know, salmon hang out in the Bering Sea for a couple of years before they start heading up the river, so it's hard to say how soon we might see some of those fish come back.
And we really don't know where those salmon go, do we? No?
No, it's a real mystery out there.
Right, and who knows? Well, let's talk a little bit more about the Mat-Su, because sport fishing is a big deal in the Mat-Su, and it looks like some of the salmon issues have hurt the Mat-Su sport fishing too. Could you tell us a little bit, Jim, about what the borough has done to help get more fish in the rivers?
The borough created this Fish and Wildlife Advisory Commission, and they are really knowledgeable people, and they have demanded science. And one of the things that happened last year is we got a proposal to change the management in Upper Cook Inlet to allow more escapement, especially of cohos and kings, into the river. And predictably, you know, the boats that fish these areas were not very pleased about this. But at least we got a vote in front of the Board of Fish 7-0 in favor of studying this, giving this a trial, and doing the science on it to see if it worked. Because previous to this, some of the interest in Upper Cook Inlet had said basically we should be allowed to catch more fish in the Upper Cook Inlet, because if one of these fish goes into your rivers, it's basically dead. It's either going to be polluted or eaten by pike, or it's going to go through bad culverts. And those things happen in very few places and are really controlled. But our fish populations have crashed. It's very, very much smaller than it was. But just this past year, they started to rebuild a little bit. And hopefully that's a good sign, because as in the case of the fisheries in Western Alaska, you don't know for sure until you monitor the situation for several years. And that's the hope, that these very science-based, very experienced people will get the results and get them tracked, and that we will rebuild the fisheries, and that will be a big deal for people in Mat-Su and Anchorage, because it's not a very long drive to start fishing in Mat-Su rivers from Anchorage.
No, it isn't, or anywhere else on the road system for that matter. And we have in May the opening of the fishing season, and people are warming up their dip nets right now as we speak.
But we do have, you know, people do eat the fish. There is personal use, there is sport use, there's tourism. It is a real important economic driver to the Mat-Su.
And it's an issue that is so close to Alaskans' hearts. I think Alaska and salmon and bears are all synonymous. Well, let's turn back to Nancy over here, Nancy Merriman. Have you got any comments you'd like to make about how people can help change the legislature's mind on Medicaid expansion?
I think, legislators are very keen to hear personal stories about how healthcare coverage has made a difference in people's lives. And I think that kind of personal evidence resonates with them. Residents are their constituents, and so that's who they are elected to serve. I think folks can remind legislators that we have already paid federal taxes that are paying for the Affordable Care Act implementation, and that by not accepting Medicaid expansion, we leave about $300,000 on the table that could be used for the health and welfare of families and Alaskans, and that really that money can be used to strengthen our healthcare system here.
I have heard, though, one more question for you, that the expansion would only affect childless adults. Why is that?
There are about 40,000 Alaskans that would be eligible under the Medicaid expansion population. It would include everybody who has incomes under 138% of the federal poverty level. Now, about half of those people are actually working individuals that don't have the benefit of employer-sponsored health care coverage. So they do include childless adults who are already contributing to our communities in an economic way, but would be much better off if they could get preventive care, primary care, and then when they are sick, be able to get health care coverage earlier in the development of disease.
Okay, thanks, Nancy. We are running out of time. I'd like to say goodbye to our guests. Thank you very much, Nancy Merriman, Lauren Rosenthal out there in Unalaska, and Jim Sykes from the Mat-Su Borough. And I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer. Thanks for joining us here on Alaska Edition on Alaska Public Media. We'll be back next week with more guests for you and maybe some denouement is the word to our legislative fight down there in Juneau. Thanks for listening.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.